I'm author and critic David Agronoff. I'm a horror and science fiction author, critic, and researcher. In this podcast, I wanted to provide in-depth interviews and panel discussions with everyone from New York Times bestselling authors to researchers, musicians, and anyone I find interesting. Welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. Hello and welcome to episode 127 of Postcards from a Dying World. I am your host, David Agronoff, author of The Last Night to Kill Nazis and Punk Rock Ghost Story. And this is the first of an ongoing series that's probably going to last over a year because I'm going to do most of these episodes once a month-ish. Every once in a while, we'll do more than one in a month, so I don't know how long exactly it's going to take me, but we are covering the stories from the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. If you're watching on YouTube, I'm holding up the book, but for those of you who are just listening to audio, this is Avon Books' 1970 anthology, right? It came out in 1970, Steve?
68, I think.
Oh, okay. And this covers the years 1934.
It says 70, but I believe that it was put together starting in 68. So,
right. And so these are the stories. And we're going to talk about the whole process of this because it's the first episode. And this is the only one that's going to talk about it. So I put together a powerhouse panel, as I like to say, to discuss this. So I'm going to introduce my guests here, and then we'll get into this book and this project and how it came to be. And then we were going to talk about Stanley G. Weinbaum's Amar's Martian Odyssey, which was the first story in the collection and one of the seminal stories of science fiction. And we'll get into Stanley Weinbaum, the man, and the story. But my guest today, starting representing the state of Florida in the United States, it is Steve Davidson, who is the publisher of Amazing Stories Today, the current copyright holder, which is very important. And if you want to hear the story of how Steve ended up being the owner and publisher of Amazing Stories, the longest running science fiction magazine under that name, you can listen to episode 102 of this here podcast when I talked to Steve about that and 1920s science fiction. We talked about in that episode. And so that's episode 102. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And returning to Postcards from a Dying World is Cora Bullard, who is the reigning Hugo Award winning best fan writer winner.
I'm not actually the reigning one.
Chris
M. Barkley won, who's a very, very worthy successor.
Yeah. So, but Hugo Award winner, which the last time you were on, you were just a three-time finalist. And Cora was on episode 88 of this here podcast covering, similarly, the first episode of our 1930s science fiction podcast miniseries that I did. And we covered Chamblow by Catherine Lucille Moore with Greg Cox. Highly recommend that episode. And then Cora and I podcasted before on the Dickheads podcast, episode 16 of the Dick Jason series. We covered The Big Jump by Lee Brackett, which is one of my favorite 50s science fiction novels. So I recommend you go listen to those discussions. Cora is a glorious nerd. I love to have her back on the show. So Cora, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me back again. Always happy to be here.
All right. So, Steve, we're not going to talk about your amazing story's journey because we did that in episode 102. But we're going to talk about here, I think, is one of the first things we should do is talk about the founding of SIFWA and the Science Fiction Writers Association, because I think SIFWA, you know, is really the driving force behind this anthology. And so while the Hugo Awards were already being given for quite a while at this point, The Hugo Awards are fan driven and they're voted by the fans, and the members of Worldcon are able to vote for it. And I think at the time there was a desire to have a professional award that was voted upon or given specifically by the science fiction writers, the professionals. Thus became the Nebula Awards. So that's the difference between the Hugo and the Nebula Awards. But in the founding of the Science Fiction Writers of SFWA, Science Fiction Writers Association, one of the projects that came up was the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. And one of my primary sources for researching for this episode was your blog post on Amazing from 2014. So a lot of my notes are strictly taken from that. But so you could tell us a lot of this. Maybe start off by
maybe
telling
not. You. I might have forgotten. That was quite a while ago.
Okay. That's true. But part of the idea in this anthology was to choose the greatest stories of the golden age of science fiction as voted upon by the members of SFWA. But maybe talk about, like, Steve, can you tell me anything about the founding of SFWA? And why it was so important at that time that they have this professional voting base?
Well, there were several prior attempts, like Ted Sturgeon put together, I believe, what it was called, the Science Fiction League. And that was an effort to market the short stories from the magazines to radio and television production. As things progressed, particularly probably somewhat engendered by Saul Cohen's republishing of a whole mess of stories in a variety of magazines starting in the mid-50s without paying the writers, spurred Damon Knight and a bunch of other prominent authors at the time to get together and say, we need a writer's guild to represent the science fiction and fantasy authors. Damon spearheaded that effort. It went along, it was fine, but they were looking for a way to pretty much emphasize that they had come into being and that they were an effective operation. One of the promotional vehicles that they came up with for that were the Nebulas. I mean, you know, every other writer's guild had awards or some kind of end of the year get together. SFWA followed suit, and when they came up with that, the idea was also very much so that a lot of their work was based on what had gone on prior, and not even the Hugos went back to the beginning of the field, and so they decided that since they were going to institute the Nebula Awards, they were going to put together this anthology that would represent all of the works that were ineligible for the Nebula simply because it had not existed at the time that they were published. Being the president at the time, Bob Silverberg took over the responsibility to compile the stories. And so the story goes that he went to all the members of SFWA and requested that they recommend, I believe it was no more than 5 works.
I think they were allowed to recommend 10.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Which is a lot.
as we get older, you know, memory fades on certain things. Thank goodness for Google to some degree. He did not get in enough stories recommended by the authors. I think it was 15 of the total were selected from the membership. And having been in the field for quite some time, first as a fan and then as an author, and familiar with much of the earlier works, Silverberg took it upon himself to fill out the contents, and that's what became the final version of the first Science Fiction Hall of Fame volume.
Now, according to what my notes, Nightfall was the story that got the most votes, but
Correct.
Weinbaum's A Martian Odyssey got the second most votes, and Flowers for Algernon got
Third
third. And
most,
those were the
yeah.
ones that, like, everybody, that was kind of the consensus stories that most voters gave. Now, I'm wondering, Cora, how you feel about the distinction between the Nebulas and the Hugos, because I like to think of it as, I think of things through a PKD lens because I spent so much time researching him. And he, was very proud of his Hugo that he won for Man in the High Castle. But just even getting a nomination for the Nebula felt like when it happened for Flow My Tears, he was, I think that the fact that it was other writers that were nominating him, like, gave a certain cachet to it. And I'm wondering, because I know, Corey, you're very knowledgeable about the history of the Hugos. What does the Nebulas mean to you as a fan? Like,
I mean, I do cover the nebulas at my blog. I cover the nebulas, the Hugos, and oddly enough, the Dragon Awards, which was just because they started up in 2016 and were very weird at the time, and now it's kind of tradition that I cover them.
yeah.
Them, but so yes, for me it was always when I started reading. Of course, I saw books emblazoned with Hugo winner, Nebula winner, so I very quickly figured out, okay, that means this is something special or something good. People apparently gave this an award, and if you actually read the books, they were usually good, all the stories. So it wasn't until much later that I actually knew the distinction, what the difference was between, except the, because before it was just two awards, such as the Golden Globes and the Oscars are both film awards, but a lot of people don't really know what the difference is. And so basically I like both of them. It depends, they both there's a lot of overlap, because I mean even in the first year there was a lot of the first Nebula winner for best novel was also the Hugo winner for best novel was Dune, which is about as much of a sure bet as you can have in our genre, especially in that era, because it's one of those absolutely everybody agrees it's a classic, even if they don't, even the people who don't care for Dune agree that it's a classic. And there's been a lot of overlap since in the nominations and also the winners. The Nebulas do tend to occasionally recognize nice stories that also novels that Hugos missed because they were published in smaller venues which a lot of Hugo voters simply might have missed. Nowadays it's probably because not a lot of people reads at least not enough people read the print magazines anymore, so it's easier for some for a story good story published in Asimov's or FNSF or Analog to get a ne Nebula nomination, simply because Nebula because CIFA members are more likely to have read it. But I mean there's also a lot of, let's say, overlap in membership, because most pros are also fans. A lot of fans are also pros in some form. Also, not everybody who qualifies is a CIFA member. I actually qualify. I'm not a member, not because I don't want to, but it's simply because I haven't gotten around to applying yet. I basically have the paperwork ready. I just didn't get around to it because there's a lot going on in my life right now.
Yeah, well, and it's kind of similar situation for me with HWA is like I qualify to be in the Horror Writers Association, but I had been waiting for a very specific thing in my head, which was a nationally distributed book, which I now have with The Last Night to Kill Nazis. So I am officially joining
It's always a
HWA.
good night to kill Nazis, I think. I mean,
Yes, exactly. Now, so with the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, I'll tell the story of this is my second copy of it. I bought it when I was a kid at a used bookstore in my hometown in Indiana because I was buying lots of science fiction. And at the time, two names that were like kind of surefires for me were Richard Matheson and Isaac Asimov. At the time, I was reading everything by them. And I remembered that I was buying a lot of Asimov and such. And there's a kind of grumpy bookseller at this used bookstore that I used to go to when I was a kid. And he just recently retired and sold the store, by the way. A Caveat Emptor is the name of the store in my hometown. A lot of my books started there. And he had told me at one point, like, he had just gotten a copy of this and he said, "You need to read this because you're reading all the science fiction." And he told me to buy it. And I am ashamed to say that I never read it back then and somehow lost my copy of it and didn't get this until last year. I was in Indiana visiting family and I found this at a used bookstore. And when I looked at the table of contents, this whole podcast series was immediately in my head. And so I rebought it for this purpose. And so I am going to be rereading many, some of these stories I've read before, but basically I'm going to read these as I do the series. So that's my story on that. Steve, when did you first read the Science Fiction Hall of Fame?
I was 10. I had just previously raided the bookmobile that came to my elementary school and acquired Wells and Verne and this odd-looking thing called Starman Jones by some guy named Heinlein. After reading the classics, I read Starman Jones, and that was pretty much it. For me, as far as getting into science fiction, then I made the happy discovery of these things called anthologies. And at the time, 10 years old, 11 years old, very naive about pretty much everything in the world at that time. So the concept of an anthology was new to me, and I realized that for the price that I had been spending for a single author's work, I could acquire exposure to a whole mess of authors. And the first one that I picked up was Campbell's Astounding Tales of Space and Time. And shortly thereafter, Hall of Fame was published. Now, it was earlier, but I was unaware of hardbacks and all that other kinds of stuff. And I picked up a copy of this probably at a Walden's Books. Somewhere in New Jersey. And it confirmed my idea that buying anthologies was an extremely rewarding experience because I would end up with 20 or 30 names that I could determine I liked or I didn't like. And then I could go back to the bookshelves and find works by those people, knowing that I would get some kind of a good read.
Now, Cora, when did you have you read this book before, or you read the stories individually?
I've read most of the stories at some point, but I've not actually read this anthology because it was published before I was born. So was and of course it's been reprinted a couple of times, but somehow it never crossed my orbit when I was like Steve, a kid hanging out in the and of course in Germany it was even more difficult because okay. I mean, there was a lot of there was homegrown science fiction. There were translations. They were mostly in these little magazine type things. Terra and Utopia were the names of those lines. The translations were often abbreviated. The quality was variable. Occasionally, the translator managed to give the twist away in the title. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Walter Ernsting, for that one. So you had to go to the import bookstore. We only had one in town, and it had I think two spinner racks of paperbacks, which were a mix of there was a few romances. Okay, didn't care about those. There were mysteries, yes, sometimes, and there was science fiction and fantasy. And I basically went through it, looked at the grabbed whatever looked exciting, looked at the blurb. after a while, I figured out some authors were good. Asimov was one of them. Well, then I discovered, like, okay, this one's good. And also, my first Heinlein was also Starman Jones, picked up from Zed Spinnerack at Stormbücher. Stormbücher still exists, but it's much smaller now than it used to be, and it's basically just a store for art books. And they still had a lot of art books, but they had a huge foreign language section back then to cater to university students. It was way before Amazon. So basically, it was me and was usually a lot of university students, often boys, who were always very, very interested in what I was reading, which I found very, very annoying. Like, what are these guys looking at? Are they judging me for my reading? I was a little bit stupid, I guess. Yes, and so, yeah, I mean, if you're 15, 16 and quite cute, and there's a boy of maybe 18 or 19 looking at you, he was probably checking out what I was reading. But it wasn't like, okay, the guy who's buying the math book is curious what I'm reading. And how did I find out about authors which were interesting to read without scouring the bookstore and because and everything else you had to special order? Well, I found the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction. I have the first two editions, because when I knew it was hugely expensive, I think it took up a lot of my it was a big hardcover, and there's a picture of Metropolis on the cover, which is of course a good thing, and it took up my a lot of pocket money, Christmas money, birthday money, Freimarkt, which is our autumn fair. If there's Freimarkt, your grandparents will give you some money to go on the rides. I didn't go on the rides. I saved my money and report card money. So it was a lot of money, for a kid, ridiculous amount of money. I dropped on this book, which I found not at the Storm bookstore, but at a shop in Rotterdam called De Bijenkorf, the Beehive, which is a high-end department store with a very good book department, including lots of English language books. So yeah, I had the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction. I read through it. I made notes of, okay, this sounds interesting, and then tried to track down the books. And that's how I found actually a lot of these stories at some point in some context. There were very few where I thought, like, okay, I've never read this one before.
Right. And we're going to lean heavily on your knowledge of old school science fiction as we get through it. One thing I want to say right off the bat before, as we're starting this series on this book of the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, before we really get into it, I think it's time to redo the Science Fiction Hall of Fame right around the time of the centennial. And the way I would do it is to give each decade its own, like, Hall of Fame
volume,
right? And because I'm going to break down these numbers. This research was done by a young researcher in 2014 by the name of Steve Davidson, who I get these numbers from. So thank you, Steve, for this work, because you broke down, for example, the decades. Now, all these stories come from 1934 to 1963 is the most recent in this volume.
It makes sense. The Nebula started up in 1965.
Right. The 30s only are represented by 3 stories. Okay. The 40s by 10 stories, the 50s by 12, and one from the 60s, from the first couple of years of the 60s. So I know that all three of us agree you could do a whole book of 30 science fiction and represent it. I did a whole mini series on this podcast about 30 science fiction, and some of the ones that, you know, I chose to cover: Catherine Lucille Moore's Chamblow, Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness. You know, this book has Campbell with Twilight, but Who Goes There is arguably more important. And we also covered Alas, All Thinking by Harry Bates, and Clifford Simak's the football one. I'm brain farting the name, but Simak's represented here. So
not with the story I would have chosen, but okay.
Yeah.
This is one of the really baffling one choices, I think, because there's a much better story story actually from the same series.
Right. Well, I would have chosen other Cimax as well. But the point is that the 30s had a lot more science fiction going on, especially just Weird Tales alone, right?
There's not a single story from Weird Tales in here.
Which is
ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because Amazing was the first science fiction magazine. And that's what it will always be. But Weird Tales was the first speculative fiction magazine because they did fantasy and horror as well. Also, we're missing the entire 20s, and we're missing the 19-teens and everything before. We could go back to 19. Well, actually, we could go back to, but before 1900, it gets a little bit thin in the ground.
So, really quickly, do you guys have picks for the 1920s that you think would have represented this? Starting with Steve.
No, but I had two things that I wanted to point out that are kind of offline a little bit, and then I'll get back to that.
Okay.
First, Cora's account to me exemplifies the persistence of science fiction fans.
Yeah.
We're a non-proselytizing organization. We all have to find our own way. And the ones that stay in this are the ones that exhibit that kind of persistence. So good for you, Cora. and the other thing was that actually there was a magazine called The Thrill Book, which World Tales. It only had a couple of issues and it was very unfocused, but it was also kind of trying to cover the macabre and the outlandish and the weird and the horror kind of speculative genres. No, I don't have any particular specific recommendations. I might have a list if I had known that I was going to be asked that question.
Right. Sorry to hit you with that.
No, that's perfectly okay. I'm explaining myself rather than complaining about the question. But I do think that one thing that is potentially problematic with probably the 20s through the 40s is that while I do not believe that most of them were written deliberately to express various concepts that we have difficulties with these days, such as casual misogyny and racism and whatnot, they are very much present and an assumption of the background that the authors wrote from, and they can be problematic because modern readers don't, for large measure, in my opinion, don't seem to be able to read something and accept it from within the context with which it was written, as opposed to trying to apply modern day values and whatnot to a particular story.
But I mean, if you pick up an anthology of science fiction from the 1920s or 19-teens, you have to accept that some attitudes will be outdated. I mean, there are two terribly sexist stories in this one. One that I honestly think, why did they pick this one? There are better stories from the same author available. The other one, like, okay, it's a classic, it's still sexist, and there's also some racist stuff in here. It's not actually that bad. There's worse, you will always run across these attitudes. I know a lot of people are not willing to get past these. These old attitudes.
You can call out the stories. I which
one? The sexist one, Coming Attractions by Fritz Leiber. Why did they pick that one? It's terribly sexist, and Leiber is a great writer. He shouldn't be represented by this story. Okay, of course, when I tried to find alternatives, most of them were like, okay, this is good, but it's fantasy or it's horror. However, it was a bit difficult deciding on a science fiction, because Leiber was more a fantasy and horror guy than he was he did write a lot of science fiction, but his fantasy and horror was simply better. He was actually mostly a horror guy. And then Helen O'Loy, I know it's a classic, but it's sexist, and also, why is Helen O'Loy pretty much the only robot story in this? The entire genre of robot stories is represented by Helen O'Loy. Yeah, not my choice, but
yeah, I'm currently trying to put together a panel for that one, and
no one wants it. Okay, well, it's not. Neither are the worst. No, okay, and of course we also have the Code Equations, which has always been called a sexist story. It kind of, it's not really. I wouldn't say it's really a sexist story, and that absolutely deserves to be here because every story we are still arguing about and trying to rebut more than 60 years after it was written deserves to be. It's almost 70 years now. Now, every story that people have been discussing and rebutting for so long deserves to be there. I've rebutted it myself. Everybody, I think, has done it at some point.
Right. Well, and and it's funny because Lieber won the Hugo for The Wanderer, which was...
Oh, God. Sorry.
Terrible book. And
I think it's one of the worst Hugo ever. It's
it is the worst.
Least liked Hugo winner of all time.
No. The second one to win, who's
which is why I said the second least liked one, because what's it called? They'd Rather Be Right is apparently worse, but most people haven't read it because it's been out of print for ages. But more people have read the Leiber, and even people who like him are like, oh, it's a Leiber, how bad can it be? Yes, it is.
It
can be bad. Sorry, he was great, he's a great writer. And most of his Hugo winners are great stories. I mean, Ilmet and Langmar is probably one of my favorite Hugo winners of all time. It's fantasy, of course, but it's a great, great story.
All right.
And
well,
this one's just nope.
I want to transition into this story pretty soon, but let's talk about like the editors who did these stories, because there's one of the things about this book that's a negative. Is the extreme bias towards John W. Campbell stories. There's 13 John W. Campbell stories in here. So there's 13 stories that came from Astounding, which, you know, is what it is. But that's a lot. There's 5 stories that came from the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. They had different editors during the times that these stories were selected. So a couple of them are Boucher and McComb stories, and a couple of them are Avren Davidson stories. Working on getting Avren's son on Dickhead soon. So everybody look out for that. And we're going to be covering Grania Davis's Dr. Grass, which is a hilarious looking book. Coming up soon on Dickheads. Well, we do nothing soon on Dickheads. Everything takes time. Fantasy Book had one story from William and Margaret Crawford, editor. Mm-hmm. 2 Galaxy stories from Gold, Horace Gold. 1 story from New Tales of Space and Time, Raymond J. Healy. 1 Planet Stories, 2 Frederick Paul stories, and then of course this one came from Wonder Stories, edited by Charles D. Forney. So
the young fan editor who was brought in by Gernsback, based on letters he had written to the magazine.
And the thing about Horn, this interesting role is you still see a lot of the essays and a lot of the work being done by Gernsback in this issue. So if you look at the issue, before we start talking about the actual issue, because I'm going to share, for those of you who are listening on audio only, the thing is that I am going to pull up on the screen for the YouTube the issue, so we can look at the table of contents a little bit. But let's talk about 1934 for a second, because this story came out in 1934. My father died in his 80s. He was born in 1936. That is my context for this. I always think of 1936 as the year Raiders of the Lost Ark took place. So, 1934 is a long time ago, right? And so what was going on in 1934? Well, you had the Dust Bowl in the United States. Yeah. Bonnie and Clyde got gunned down. Hitler came to power in
1933. No, actually, he came to power in 1933.
33.
But in 19, he was already, he'd been in power for over a year, but he was still consolidating his power. I think the Reichstag burned in 1934, so So it was, so yes, things were already were not good, but they were about to get a lot worse.
Right. It wasn't all bad. Germany also built the first TVs in 1934. So there's that. And then first international airmail was sent in 1934. These are things, so there was, yeah, this was before TV. I mean, radio was a thing.
That's new.
Yeah. But there was no regular transatlantic flights.
Transatlantic line. It was the golden age of the ocean liner. We had beautiful ocean liners. I think the Ile de France or the Normandy was later. It must have been the Ile de France or the Normandy. One of the French ones was launched in 1934. So you could, of course, travel across the Atlantic. You had wonderful ways to get there. You could take a beautiful, luxurious ocean liner. At least at this point, they were also decent if you traveled third class. They were at least decent. Decent. They were not great. And of course, you had Zeppelins. You could cross the Atlantic on the Graf Zeppelin. And wait a minute. I think Hindenburg might already have been flying. I'm not quite sure. I have to look it up now.
Now, Steve, in your article about this story, you listed all the things that didn't exist yet in technology. Mm-hmm. And I cracked up that you've listed no Velcro or Teflon.
Yeah.
You were very yes, this was pro. This was before Velcro, which I thought very interesting that you put Velcro on the list. Well, however, one of the things that's very important to notice that, I mean, Pluto was barely discovered at this time. It was discovered in the 30s. In fact, it might not have even been
I think it was 1930 or 30. It was earlier at any rate.
Yeah.
It was very 30. Early 30s.
It was new. And the reason I know this is there was a Brain Eaters from Pluto story in one of the 34 Wonder stories, because I was looking through all the letters to see the reaction for this. So I know Pluto was there. I think it was 32 Pluto was found. However, there was very little knowledge about space at all. What was going on comparatively to what we know now with our space telescopes, with our space stations and all everything.
Well, there was no space flight. Certainly not.
Yeah.
And so no probes, no pictures other than what they could get through ground-based telescopes.
So we were still under the impression that Mars was filled with canals and that there was probably people, there was still the opportunity or the belief that it was possible that Mars would be loaded with life just like ours, because our imagination saw Venus and Mars that way in particular. So that's why we have so many amazing
Martians,
C.L. Moore and Lee Brackett, awesome Venus and Mars stories. My favorite.
I call it the pulp science fiction shared solar system, because they had a very, a definite idea of what the planets were. I actually did a blog post on that. They have a bit of a blog post, because they had a definite idea of what the solar system had, ideas of what Mars would like, what Venus would be like, what Mercury was like. They're all, and the moons of Jupiter, sometimes even the surface of Jupiter, which is kind of, and even further out, Pluto, up to Pluto. They had ideas of what these planets were like, but most of these ideas are completely wrong. They made sense from what they knew at the time, but basically they were all very similar. Martian Odyssey is actually interesting simply because it's not really the Mars from the pulp science fiction shared solar system. It's a different kind of Mars.
Well, right. To some degree. Now, the scientific community, is particularly the astronomical community at that time, knew that there were no canals on Mars. They had gone through the whole Schiaparelli thing with the canals, and they knew that there were no canals there. But what kind of atmosphere it had, what the surface conditions were like, that was definitely still up for speculation. And I think that Weinbaum kind of slipped in. He added the canals, probably because that perception of the planet was still the most popular vision of Mars among the general population.
Oh yes, yeah. Regarding Schiaparelli, his niece or something, Elsa Schiaparelli, was at this time the story was written, she was one of the leading fashion designers. And she did, yes, she did some very, even today, I think the Schiaparelli designs from the 1930s and so on, still and 20s still look rather futuristic for the era they were in. So I always found it interesting that two people with this very, very unique name became famous in so very different places.
Well, I just wanted to set the stage of what we knew about Mars. Now, I want to talk about Stanley Weinbaum for a little bit. We'll come back to Wonder Stories as a magazine before we get really into the story. But Weinbaum's an interesting person. I first heard of Weinbaum through reading Robert Bloch's autobiography, The Once Around the Block. And for those who don't know, Robert Bloch, the author of Psycho, who grew up in Milwaukee, and he was a part of a fiction group in the 1930s of writers called the Milwaukee Fictioneers. And the founder of the Milwaukee Fictioneers, as it were, was or one of the main members, the most successful member of the Fictioneers. I'm not sure if he was a founder, but the most successful member was Stanley G. Weinbaum. And Bloch did not join the Fictioneers until after Weinbaum's death, but he talked in his book about how Weinbaum's legacy, and particularly the impact of this story, Martian Odyssey, loomed over that group enough that he wrote about it in his autobiography, right? And so one of the other people who was a part of the Fictioneers, who was extremely influenced, and the one who told Bloch a lot about Weinbaum, was Frederick Brown, who will appear later in this anthology with the story Arena. If Frederick Brown's a really interesting writer because he was one of the first kind of like comical science fiction writers. Mm-hmm. If you ever get a chance to read What Mad Universe by Frederick Brown, it's bananas. I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying it's bananas. it's kind of a fun read.
The Star Mouse also.
I have not read that one. I've only read What Mad Universe, to be honest. The author photo on What Mad Universe, the first edition, because the library here in San Diego has the first edition.
Wow.
From 1949. And the author photo on it is an all-timer. If you can look it up and find it. I know I put the author photo on my review on my blog, so it's there. But Frederick Brown was incredibly influenced by a short but powerful friendship with Stanley Weinbaum, according to Robert Bloch. Okay. So that was who, when I first read Mars Odyssey last year, it was because I read, you know, in Robert Bloch's autobiography, he referred to this story as one of the most important and influential science fiction stories ever written that came out of his writers group. And that's the way he introduced it. So I was like, oh, shit, I got to go read that.
Bloch is actually one of the authors who are really missing from this anthology. Okay, he was more of a horror guy than a mm-hmm. science fiction writer, but he did write science fiction stories. He even was a writer on the original Star Trek. And he's one of the authors where you really think, okay, they couldn't find one, but he should have been in here somewhere.
Yeah. And Weinbaum died at the ripe old age of 33, which is really, you know, I know it happened more, but 33 is very young. He was born in Louisville, Kentucky. He went to school in Milwaukee, grew up in Milwaukee, went to University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he started as a chemical engineering major, which explains a lot of his
other stories, spectrum in particular.
Yeah, how his stories use science, and were pretty good on the science for the time. But he ended up majoring in English at the end. In 1933, he sold a non-science fiction novel called The Lady Dances, which was serialized in newspapers. Mm-hmm. So he appeared to have written several romance novels as well.
Yeah.
Science fiction. It does not seem like he was a dyed-in-the-wool, like, committed science fiction writer. He was just a writer. And that
a lot of them back in that time frame were writing whatever they could write for a paycheck for the pulps. I mean, you know, the pulps were legion. And if they had a story that was not selling as science fiction, they might rework it as a Western or a mystery or a romance or something like that.
And we'll get more into what the actual impact of this story in a little bit, because I have quotes from Asimov, Lester Del Rey, Lovecraft, and Frederick Pohl. This story, it kind of gets pole position in the Hall of Fame for a reason, because a lot of writers in that era consider there to be science fiction before A Martian Odyssey and science fiction after, that it had that kind of impact on the genre. And if you think about, like, you know, just to use popular culture, you know, there's movies before Jaws and Star Wars, and there's movies after those, right? And they kind of changed everything for how, like, movies were, you know, they became the blockbusters. So now you gotta have
also 2001, A Space Odyssey, is another one for science fiction, a movie that's before and after, simply because it looked so much better, special effects and everything wise, than everything that had come before. Yes. That everything after had to measure up to it, similar to how Star Wars was.
Yeah. And so I think the impact of this story, I think even Robert Bloch was trying to articulate this in his autobiography, is that the impact that Weinbaum had, it's interesting because he doesn't have, like, a huge catalog of stories and novels. Like, there's not a lot out there because he died at 33. But this story was like a 10 megaton bomb, like, on the genre, because nobody had written aliens like this before. That was the big change, right? So I think that's the impact that he had. He did write other speculative fiction. There's one, he wrote an apocalypse or novel that got turned into, it's two novellas that got turned into a novel called The Black Flame. Yeah. It's on my list because it sounds like right up my alley. I love weird end of the world novels, so so I intend to read that. So he did that. I think he intended to do more science fiction.
Oh yeah.
But you know, his impact here, it's funny too, because according to, you know, the research that I read, like, he was just as shocked. Well, he was shocked that the story had that big of an impact. He you know, but really most of the impact of it, most of the circulating out of the story happened after he died. Yeah. You know, so he, like, didn't really see most of how this became, like, because the impact was, you know, slow back then, you know, because the main way it impacted the community was it changed how writers were writing stories
and thinking about stories.
Yes.
They did The Field. Many people in The Field did a memorial anthology for him, which obviously came after he was gone. I think you're correct that he was unaware of how deep an impact he would have. And one of the things that I like to speculate on, and I think that somebody who's a better writer than me might find some fertile ground in, would be a story about the science fiction field if Weinbaum had not passed so early.
Yeah, well, that would be interesting. And, you know, one of, I don't remember which story, but one of the five stories from the 30s series that I did was in an issue that had all kinds of tributes to Stanley Weinbaum in it. And I remember in our episode, we highlighted some of those tributes, and I probably should have found that and gone back and figured out which one it was. But in any case, let's talk about Wonder Story.
There are a couple of authors that we lost too young. Some of them are in this anthology, Silicon Blues, We Lost Way Too Young, Henry Kuttner. But the two, I think, who we not only lost way too young, but who also had a massive impact after their death that they never lived to see, are Robert E. Howard and Stanley Weinbaum. They died at Weinbaum at 33, Howard at 30, and Lovecraft, he was a little older, but we also lost him too soon, and he also didn't really get to see the impact he had. So these are the people who really never saw the impact they had on the genre.
Howard was only 30.
Have loved to see the stories they could have written if they had lived.
Robert Howard was only 30 when he died.
Wow. Yeah, he was 30. He was 30 and he'd started very early and was very prolific. So Weinbaum was not as prolific, and he didn't start, at least we don't, not that we know it, he didn't start that early. So that's why we have so much Howard, because he was so very, very prolific.
Yeah,
I'll toss H. Beam Piper onto that pile.
Oh, yes, that's another one who died way too soon.
He committed suicide, believing that he was a complete failure as an author.
I admit I'm not familiar with this author, so.
You're familiar with his most famous creation, believe me. You are familiar with the Little Fuzzy, so you probably know that.
Oh, the Little Fuzzy. Oh, yes. Okay. Never mind. Yes, I am.
He's the guy who invented what became the Ewoks.
Exactly. all right, let me share a screen with the people who are watching on YouTube. They can see my very dirty desktop for a second. Okay.
That's nothing, but go ahead.
This is the table of contents in the July 1934 issue of Wonder Stories. When you're doing research for stories like this, and this time, you also have to read the next two issues' letters to really see what people were thinking. And Martian Odyssey was immediately a fan favorite. There were several letters calling for sequels and more stories like it, including letters from Oklahoma and Washington State, and so it just kind of showed, like, I thought that was kind of neat. So these are the we start with an editorial by Gernsback. Now this was a fan edited issue, I think. Really, none of these other stories are ones that I remember hearing of. I don't really know many of these other than Endo Binder.
Yeah, Endo Binder is the only one who is remembered these days. The other ones, yeah. I've never heard of them. I would love to know who did the Rocket Ships news article, because it might have been Willy Ly.
He was writing articles for,
I think it might have been Wonder Stories. I don't know which magazine. He was one of the American science fiction magazines. He was writing articles about rocket ships and early rocket experiments for them in the 1930s when he was living in Germany. And then one day the Gestapo knocked on his door and said, you've been writing these articles for foreign publications. And he said, science fiction, we'll all go to the moon together, blah, blah. And they said, you can't do this. It's classified knowledge. And then Lai said, well, can I at least write stories? And they said, no, you can't write science fiction stories. So Lai said, well, bye-bye then, and took off to the US. Good for him. And later on, of course, all his old friends from the Raketen Club showed up, and they all built, and they all worked at NASA together. So this might actually have been one of his.
Yep.
Right. And so...
Philip Wiley is there, but it's just a book review, because he's another one who's actually remembered.
Right. Well, an Endo Binder like that, it was part one of a three-part serialization of a novel, and that novel got reprinted many, many times. And if people don't know, Endo Binder was a pen name for two brothers.
Yep. E and O.
Yeah. And they're probably the only other
writers of Supergirl,
right,
and later comic writers, and the Adam Link robot stories.
And Adam Link,
yeah.
Yeah, and so What do you guys know about the history of Wonder Stories? It was a spinoff of Astounding, correct?
Right. Yeah,
No.
amazing.
Or Amazing?
No. Gern's back lost Amazing and his publishing empire in 29. And within 6 months, he had two new science fiction magazines out on the stands, Science Wonder Stories and Air Wonder Stories. Air Wonder, after a very few issues, was merged into Science Wonder Stories, which then changed its name to Wonder Stories and was eventually sold in 36 to become Thrilling Wonder Stories.
Now, I do want to look at Enslaved Brains for a second, the Endo Binder, because this art is the amazing, thrilling
it's
world.
Frank R. Paul. He's a birthday buddy of mine. We share a birthday. I share a birthday with Frank R. Paul.
And I love how it says here, we are shown the effects of civilization of 1973 would have on man lost in the jungle. So this is like okay. The wonderful future of 1973.
Hey, I was just born. Only yeah. That the world didn't look like that. I mean, I kind of miss my beautiful flying wings or whatever those things are.
Yeah. I this is one of my favorite things that I saw flipping through the issue. You can see this is the cover. And Steve, you've got a version of the cover there. Yeah. And there's the free radio catalog ad, which is great.
Gern's Back was still very heavily into radio and also television at the time. He had the Radio League of America, I believe it was called, which actually petitioned Congress successfully to get a carve out for amateur radio. All the ham radios owe their ability to have part of the radio spectrum devoted to them to Gern's Back and the Radio League.
Yeah, and it appears that the cover has some kind of hyper tube that will take you New York to Sydney, which is awesome. I'm still waiting for the hyper tube.
Yeah, that would be lovely.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, the Frank R. Paul art still has an impact today. I mean, you still see, if you've seen, it was one of the Star Wars prequels. I think the second one, Attack of the Clones. There's pretty much these large circular things, which are, and they've shown up elsewhere, these large circular sort of motorcycles. When I was in the cinema watching Attack of the Clones, I screamed like, oh my God, it's a Frank R. Paul cycle. And everybody was like, what is this crazy person doing?
Yeah, let's talk about Frank R. Paul. He was he was Gern's Beck's like probably number one artist.
Go-to guy, yep.
His go-to guy. So a lot of the art from the 30s science fiction is his, and
one of the greats.
Yeah, one of the greats.
Yeah, for the 30s, it's basically Frank R. Paul and Margaret Brandes, who are the most impactful science fiction and fantasy illustrators of very different, very 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 different works.
Here's
later we have.
New readers get acquainted with science fiction.
I've just started quoting each paragraph individually on Facebook as a public science fiction announcement.
That's awesome. This is to explain what science fiction is. I like how it's habit forming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it kind of is. But I always love these ancient articles. Oh, yes, there we have it.
And then here's
Tweel.
Tweel, yes.
Jarvis.
And Jarvis.
Yeah. And this art is great. This art is fantastic.
Of course, we don't know that his name is really Tweel. It might be Perut or something else.
Well, Jarvis calls him Tweel.
One last thing I want to say about Frank R. Paul and his art is that I saw a quote here saying that the first science fiction images seen by Ray Bradbury, Arthur C. Clarke, Forrest J. Ackerman was his art. So, you know, that's an interesting way to put it. But It's all right.
In that era, it was either Frank Appel or you'd see Metropolis, if you've been lucky enough to see it.
A surprising number of our founding generation of authors were first exposed to the genre either through Amazing or Science Wonder Stories. I have a piece on the website about where did you first get exposed to science fiction, and it goes through a list of people like Asimov and Pohl and et cetera, and listing their first magazine by issue.
So and again, I apologize to the audio listeners, who audio only listeners, this is one part where you might want to go over to the YouTube, because we've got the original appearance of Martian Odyssey up on the screen, which has this amazing artwork, this really great drawing of Tweel being like an ostrich-like character. And I did not see Tweel that way really in my head until I saw that picture. Now I can't get it out of my head, and it makes, I think, makes the story like 10 times better too. But one thing I should note, and this was an unintentional retroactively I'm gonna say it's an homage, but my science fiction novel Goddamn Killing Machines, the main character's name is Nick Jarvis. So I'm going to say that that's a homage to a Martian Odyssey that I hadn't read yet when I wrote it. So, but Jarvis is our main character. He's one of the scientists. He's the chemist, I believe. Chemist of the crew, which is a nod to Weinbaum's chemical engineering degree, apparently, and probably, but let's see what what
actually,
the editorial.
What's really interesting about this crew is a spaceship crew, is that it's an international crew. We have two. Possibly American or maybe British characters, Harrison and Jarvis. We have German character Schatz, who also speaks German a few times. I think it's probably likely very influenced by Yiddish, because some of this doesn't work in German. And then we have a French character, Leroy, or Leroy, or whatever he calls himself, which is quite interesting for a story from 1934 to have an international crew.
Yes. And let's look at what because each Wonder Stories comes with a little editorial comment. That's how we got that cool thing about 1973 in the Endo Binder one. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll read parts of it. It is most curious thing. This is how it starts. No doubt one of the greatest wonders of our Wonder Stories that practically all authors have an idea that future explorers will step into another world and find conditions like they are on Earth. They picture human beings with 2 feet, 2 legs, 2 eyes, just as we have them here. Although the chances are not one in a million that such conditions will even remotely prevail, biologists are pretty much unanimous on this point and feel that if there is such a thing as intelligent life on Mars or Venus, it certainly will be radically different from human life here that we know here. So then, but toward the bottom, it says, our present author, fully conscious of this thought, has written a science fiction tale so new, so breezy, that it stands on its head and shoulders over similar interplanetary stories. The mere fact that he keeps you guessing is the main charm of the story. And with this, coupled with a lighter vein in which it is written, makes it all the more charming. We are prevailing upon the author to let us have a sequel, which we hope to present soon. Oops. That did not happen. But
yeah, the sequel, this Valley of Dreams, is the sequel to Martian Odyssey.
Is it?
Yes.
I did not even know that such a thing existed. I thought he died right after writing this, but
no, now you have
he lived for another year or so.
Oh, okay.
Wonderful opportunity of being able to visit with Tweel again.
Excellent. Well, now I get to do that. Interesting introduction. I think they knew what they had on their hands, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, Gernsback had been editing science fiction for 8 years now. Actually, if you will think of his other magazines, he'd been editing science fiction before that. He knew this was something very different from what you usually get.
I think he also knew that it exemplified exactly what he was trying to achieve with science fiction in terms of making it both entertaining and educational.
Right. And eventually, John W. Campbell would come up with this saying where he says, write me a creature who thinks as well as a man, sexist, but whatever, or better than a man, but not like a man, you know. And I think it was already done here, but sexist.
I'm pretty wording. Sure that this story is what Campbell had in mind when he said that quote.
Yeah.
Campbell, so, very, very likely.
So Asimov said, as one of three stories that changed the way all subsequent stories in the science fiction genre have been written. I'm not sure what other two stories he's referring to, but one of them might have been his own. And maybe he was being humble about that. Lester Del Rey said, Weinbaum, more than any other writer, helped to take our field out of the doldrums of the early 30s into the beginnings of modern science fiction. Lovecraft said, Weinbaum's writing was ingenious and that he stood miles above the other pulp fiction writers in the creation of genuinely alien worlds, in contrast to Edgar Rice Burroughs and his inane stories of egg-laying princesses. What Lovecraft said. And Frederick Paul said, before Weinbaum, science fiction's aliens might be catmen, lizardmen, antmen, plantmen, or rockmen, but they were always incurably men. Weinbaum changed that. It was the difference in orientation and drives, goals, and thought processes that made Weinbaum types of aliens so fresh and rewarding to science fiction in the mid-30s. So those are pretty interesting quotes. What did you guys think? Now, when did you first read this story, Steve?
When I was 10 or 11, back in 1970 or maybe, yeah, right around that time.
And Cora, when did you first read this story?
Must have been about 30 years ago or so. I was in my, I found it fairly early in my science fiction journey in some kind of anthology of best of stories.
Admittedly, I read it last year.
Okay.
The first time. This was my second time reading it for this purpose.
Also, come to think of, since you said that Frederick Brown was strongly influenced by Weinbaum, I can absolutely see this now. I didn't know this before, but having read some Brown, I can absolutely see the influence.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a touch of humor.
Yeah.
Particularly the ending. And wouldn't surprise me at all if the two, Weinbaum and Brown, that was what brought them together as authors.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And then, hold on, let me stop share. Okay, so yeah, I think what struck me reading it last year, and I read it because of Robert Bloch mentioning it, and because he made it, you know, he correctly said it was so important. I was like, okay, now I got to know what the story is. Yeah, it struck me for 1934. It's so advanced in its thinking for the time. And it's obvious when you're reading it right away, like, this is way ahead of its time, you know. But a lot of the classics that we have highlighted on this show, you know, are all way ahead of their time for the 30s. So it's fair to say that there was more going on in the 30s and people were realizing, I think, from our older perspective, you know,
it's most of the,
yeah,
the entire golden age, radium age, silver age, new wave era. There's always more going on than you think. Several different there's always stories which are way ahead of the time and stories which are way beyond, way back in the times. I mean, Edgar Rice Burroughs got his first and only posthumous Hugo nomination in the mid-1960s for a Palissy Dar story, which had been rediscovered and reprinted, which is and which is and both is someone you associate with the 19th and 20s, way before Martian Odyssey.
Yeah, and I think the impact of this story, obviously, I mean, a lot of authors have made direct homages to this story, ones that had gone over my head before, but, and I know an actual valley in Mars was named after something from this story, or in dedication to Weinbaum, I think, and I read that somewhere. And you know, when you look at the impact of what's going on in this story is that, yeah, it's a little dated now if you look at it by today's standards. But, you know, the three of us all like to read old science fiction, not for how it lines up with today. But I think if you're reading 1930s science fiction, you kind of have to put yourself in the headspace of the time. And if you do that, you're going to be really rewarded with a really clever story that is fun, entertaining, and it has, you know, kind of a wry sense of humor, you know, and has really cool ideas. You got tentacle creatures, you got bird-like creatures, and I definitely think that, you know, the fact that
the brick shitter is wonderful. It's a pyramid creature.
Yeah, and Mars pyramids, and you got you know, the fact that
silicon-based life forms. I think yes. This might be the first silicon-based life form in science fiction. At any rate, I don't know of any earlier example.
And there's no universal translator, so like they have to learn to communicate. It does happen a little quickly, but
makes my linguist heart happy.
Yeah. Right. And I don't know how much that was done before this point, because I'm not an expert on what was there and what wasn't there.
Most of it was the aliens possessed the technology that allowed them, where they had been studying us for ages and picked up our language, or they had mental telepathy of some kind that allowed them to communicate without having to go through the whole translation thing.
Yeah, people were just trying to cheat it. Oh. Right, which is fine. You want that every once in a while, but like, you know, it's good to see the hard stuff start.
I think John Carter actually has to learn the Martian language, but we don't really get to see much of it.
That's true. That does happen to John Carter.
because that's basically just a bit that Boros jumps over.
Yeah, no magical elixir.
No, they don't have, Boros still has magical travel to Mars. At least by this point, they had rockets.
Magical travel, yes, but no, not magical.
Not magic, but they don't have they don't have magical universal translators.
Right.
Right.
One thing that I'd like to point out, I don't know if you were planning on getting to it later, but one of the unique things about this story is that Weinbaum pulls you through the landscape along with Tweel and Jarvis. He does not
absolutely
message any of the description by giving you a long exposition. And you mentioned Burroughs. Burroughs does that with, as he's introducing the creatures and the places and the things that are on Barsoom. Here, you are literally experiencing these vistas and these creatures and these new things as the character is experiencing them, and in the same fashion that he does. We have limited knowledge. We don't know what's going on. Everything is a mystery, and it might or might not be explained later on in the story, just as if you were experiencing an alien landscape yourself for the first time. And I think that is one of the strongest elements of this story.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the alien is the thing that I focused on, like Tweel in the character for a lot of it. But, you know, and it's funny too, because when the pyramids showed up, it was, you know, my reaction is reading it was, oh, that's cool. You know, just like, you know, that's just like a fun, neat little part of it. And, you know, but, and I'm trying to keep these episodes to an hour and a half. So I'm going to start to, and I knew this episode would focus more on like the process of the Hall of Fame, and this story probably isn't going to get the attention it deserves because the other episodes are going to be a little bit more on the actual stories than this one was. But I also think that I really wanted to get into who Weinbaum was as a person, because it's really sad that he died at 33 years old. We didn't get to see, and who knows, he may have written more romance novels than he did science.
Maybe he would have made his, I mean, you never know. He might have, he might have gone, made his mark elsewhere, but I think he, but I think if he'd lived a few years longer, he would have been one of John W. Campbell's stable of astounding writers, because this is very much an astounding story at a time when astounding already existed, but wasn't yet the astounding we know today. Today it wasn't, because the astounding we know is mostly Campbell's astounding. Pay much attention to the astounding of 1930 to 1930, what was it? 7, I think.
Astounding was not nearly as influential during this period of time as it became.
Yeah.
It was just one of many similar pulp SF magazines on the stands at the time.
Now, speaking of your magazines, Steve, in 1932, Amazing Stories published an Endo Binder story called The First Martian. Has anybody read that one? Because I think some people thought that this was that story was like an earlier attempt to do some of the same stuff, but wasn't as successful. It didn't.
I'm not familiar with that. I have a fair number of the Binder's stories, but I'm not familiar with that one. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm only just. It was mentioned in one of the letters about Martian Odyssey, that basically they said this was that Martian Odyssey was a more successful like
version of that kind of thing.
Yeah. And so it's funny because this is the one that everybody remembers, and I've never heard of the Endo Binder one until I saw it in a letter from apparently a reader in Oklahoma. That's what I have in my notes.
Okay.
I always love these letters, especially since they often give city and state names. And if someone has an unusual name, you can look them up. I actually did this once with a quite very, very famous letter to Weird Tales from a fan complaining about C.L. Moore, Cyril of Laurie's story. So was the first one, I think, Black Girl. Well, we don't want this women. And this letter is quoted over and over again about Weird Tales readers didn't want these stories by women. It completely ignores that the writer of the letter says that he loved the Northwest Smith stories, which were also by C.L. Moore.
Uh-huh.
Moore, of course, he didn't know she was a woman. And actually, this guy had a unique name, an unusual place where he came from. So I actually Googled him and found the letter quoted over and over again. But I also found an entry on an ancestry site or find a grave or something like this. And it turned out he was 14 years old when he wrote that letter. Okay, so here's a 14-year-old boy from a place somewhere in Pennsylvania, who was a radio amateur and writing a letter to Vittel saying, "I want more Northwest Smith, I want more Conan, I don't want this women's stuff, this girly stuff here." Which is like, yes, he's 14, of course he wants more Conan. Who wouldn't? Which 14-year-old boy wouldn't? But everybody is quoting. Everybody has quoted this letter all over again as, oh, this is what readers of Weird Tales were thinking. Even though they obviously weren't in the same issue, and B, no one ever checked this guy out to put his comments into perspective.
Well, you know, it was an eighth grade Philip K. Dick writing to Steve's magazine, Amazing Stories, in 1944.
Yeah, I love finding these things.
Yeah. Philip K. Dick wrote a letter, and that was how when I went to Berkeley, we found one of his houses that none of the researchers knew that he lived in before. I believe it was SSF Audio, Jesse, who sent me a copy of the letter and said, "Hey, do you know about this house?" And then we found the house that he lived in only for 2 years with his mother, because the letter was in the back of Amazing Stories in 1944. And by the way, we got to the the neighbor was coming out to take out the trash and saw David Gill and I standing on the street, like looking like weirdos. And he was apparently a dickhead. So we started talking to him and he had the lady told the lady, he was like, yeah, I know her. And we ended up talking to the lady that lived in the house. And she had lived in the house since the 60s and had no idea that this famous writer had lived in her house for 2 years and was very thankful that these two weirdos were standing outside of her house and let her know that this famous author lived in
her house. Some of these houses eventually get turned into museums. So he has saved the birthplace of the Bronte sisters Saunton, I think, Saunton in Yorkshire. And of course, the Robert E. Howard Museum is a museum now.
There's a family living in the Francisco house that Phil lived in during the 50s. And that's the one that I went up and touched the house. I felt really creepy about it. But that was where the bathroom that inspired Time Out of Joint and like with the light switch and all that.
The people that live there,
they've lived there for 10 years. They know it's Phil's house.
Because they have dickheads in front of the house all the time.
They put the kibosh on a little plaque outside. They didn't want that. There's a plaque outside of Anthony Boucher's house, by the way.
Can you imagine the concerned call to the police? Yeah, there's a bunch of dickheads outside my house.
Yeah. But the Francisco house is one that I think one day I hope somebody buys that house and turns it into a museum. Because he wrote everything in the 50s, all of his short stories in the 50s, all of his novels in that house. That's the house he was living in when they were getting food from the pet store, famously, which is now a karate dojo now, the pet food store.
Is that the house he was in when the whole FBI is following me? And
that was Marin County. This is the house he lived in with Cleo in the 50s. And he wrote Solar Lottery, The Man Who Japed, like all the 50s stuff. So it's.
Because Philip K. Dick is another author we lost. He lived longer than Weinbaum or Howard and so on, but we lost him too soon. And he also didn't get to see the impact he had because he didn't even get to see Blade Runner. So and never he didn't really get to see the whole impact he had. And he never also his daughters are making the money, which is good for them. But
yeah, well, speaking as the person who just finished writing the unfinished PKD. He also left behind lots of unfinished, really great stuff. And his outline for his last novel, he did four attempts to do The Owl in the Daylight, but the fourth of the concepts, the one he was actually going to sit down and write, would have been a really groundbreaking piece of alien science fiction. And I'm really sad that we didn't get it, but you could read about it in my book soon, Unfinished PKD, which is a horrible segue and plug. But any last things you guys want to say about Martian Odyssey before I promote our next episode in this series?
One of my pet peeves, I guess you have to say, is the criticism that a lot of early science fiction gets regarding its characterization and or lack thereof, the claim of lack thereof. And Martian Odyssey is another example of using stock characters, the chemist, the biologist, the engineer, but in an effective characterization manner. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Martian Odyssey is, well, it suffers from the curse of the groundbreaking story, which has been superseded by later attempts simply because when it came out in 1934, there had been nothing like it before. Okay, maybe this Binder story I've never read and never heard of. But of course, to a modern reader, you have to put yourself in the mindset of the 1930s to see how groundbreaking this story was, because to a modern reader, it's basically a travelogue across Mars. And yes, the characterization, I mean, the most memorable character is Tweel, but then I suspect he's supposed to be the most memorable character. The other guys are stock characters, but I still think it's very, very progressive for the era that these are, that this is an international crew, because it's not that unusual. Lensman also has some international characters. They're not all, this is something which really, really surprised me the first time I read it, was that there was a German general or something. Because you almost never get positive German characters in early science fiction, or even modern science fiction. So this is quite, yes, it's a case that we often have with very, very early science fiction. It's, you also have, for example, as I mentioned, Lanzmann, E.E. Smith, or lots of early science fiction that it has been superseded by later attempts, but this was the first time someone did this. This was the foundation, and that's why the story is still worth reading. Also, it's well written, it's fun, it's not very long, and it's not a slog or anything. It's still a good story, even almost 90 years later. But if you want to see where a lot of today's ideas of aliens come from, this is it. Also, especially talking about Frederick Brown, you're doing Arena eventually. Arena's very alien, mm-hmm. was probably influenced by very much influenced by this, or by the Weinbaum aliens in general. And Frederick Brown has some very alien aliens for the era.
Yeah, agreed. And, so I'm going to tie my little bow on Martian Odyssey is that I think it deserves its place here in the Hall of Fame. This one fits not all the stories I'm going to say that about. One of the things I wanted to do in this series eventually is, you know, end with what story by this author deserved to be here more than this one, because a couple of these stories, this is one where obviously I think this one deserves to be here, and it's also not much of a choice
with Weinbaum for science fiction stories. So that's basically exactly. There's a Dark Flame and there's Valley of Dreams and this one. So
do we all agree that this story is a great opener for the Hall of Fame? Because I think
absolutely.
Okay, we all agree on that. Okay, well, our next episode in this series, I'm not sure if it's going to be the next episode of the podcast, but I have already booked our panel for Twilight by John W. Campbell. We're going to have the guy who literally wrote the book on John W. Campbell, Alec Neville Lee. Yes, will be joining us on the Twilight panel. And James Reich, the publisher of Stalking Horse Press and author of The Moth for Stars and Song My Enemies Sing, which is a great, if you never read James Reich's novel, The Song My Enemies Sing, it's a great tribute to out-of-date Martian science fiction that was written a few years ago. It was one of my favorite novels of, I think, 2018 when it came out, 2019. But James, that novel is a love letter to out-of-date Martian science fiction and a modern novel. So James is going to be on that panel. And then doctoral student and science fiction scholar Kate Hefner will be rounding out the panel. So it'll be Alec, James, and Kate for Twilight by John W. Campbell next time. And then after that, we have Helen Aloy by Lester Del Rey. And I have not put a panel together for that one yet. I'm working on it.
Probably not going to be very easy.
Yeah. Well, that one I'm trying to get a robotics expert, and I don't know if that's worthwhile. Because it's the story.
Yeah, it's a pity, like I said, that's the only robot story in this, because we should have had an Asimov robot story, but of course we have Nightfall for Asimov, which is one of these all-time classics that you just can't ignore. But we don't really have but it's a pity that we have no other robot story from the Golden Age other than Helen Aloy.
If you want a robot story, you should have had The Proud Robot.
Yeah, The Proud Robot would have been good. Of course, we already have Kuttner. Well, Proud Robot was solo Kuttner. But we already have Kuttner. Could, yeah, more familiar as a Borogrovs, which is wonderful.
You have Louis Paget here. You could still have Kuttner, I think.
Yes, of course. We will pretend to not to know that Louis... I mean, we're also missing Lawrence O'Donnell then. And of course, I mean, you could put together a whole anthology just of Kuttner and Moore and their various pen
Yeah.
names.
Right. Yeah, and I love that Malzberg
Okay. We have a robot. We have a robot in the huddling place. I forgot the name now of the robot. Robot
Oh,
Kenneth.
yeah,
There's a robot
right.
butler. But
True.
it's not a robot story.
All right. Steve, how can folks find you and Amazing Stories online?
www.amazingstories.com.
And what have you got coming up with? You got a convention coming up for the
Well, we
100th?
have we've introduced last couple of months some new features. One is called for the magazine online. One is called Unexpected Questions, which is a interview series where authors and artists and editors answer unexpected questions. We're also we're working on doing a podcast of readings of new works that are coming out. Right now I've got something like 12 or 14 authors lined up to do that, where I'm still investigating technologies to do that with. But we're all and then the big thing that you mentioned, thank you, is the SF 100 convention, which is going to be taking place in April of 1926, online and live in Richmond, Virginia, or close enough, which is a celebration of 100 years of science fiction and Amazing Stories magazine.
Which I think is awesome.
Thank
And
you.
I'm really excited you're doing that. Cora, how do people find the Hugo Award-winning writing of Cora Bullard?
Well, you can find me online at corabulot.com. It's CORABUHLERT. And you can also find me under the same name on Twitter or whatever the X or whatever it's called now, on Blue Sky, on Mastodon. So yes, I'm all over the social media place. And you can also, if you put the name into Amazon or any other online bookstore, you can also find my books and stories.
Or
Awesome.
if you go to the Hugo Awards website.
Yes, you can also find my name listed on the Hugo Awards website.
Woohoo! Yeah, pretty exciting. I was very I was when I read that you won, I remember sitting in my chair and going like this. I was very proud of you,
Well, I
Cora.
mean,
Very
well,
excited for
thanks a
you.
lot. I actually learned that because I wasn't on site. I learned that I won via a Zoom chat because I was in the because the Voxer finalists were in Zoom to be switched online, and because the person who won the Astounding Award, Shelley Parker Chan, she was also virtual because she's in Australia, and she had no idea that she'd won because you can't hear the live stream if you're in the Zoom. Otherwise, you would get a feedback. And so I told the guy who did the Zoom moderator later. I told him, you should maybe let us know who won, otherwise, because otherwise we won't know. So, and I was the first person to actually profit from that. And so I learned that I'd won a Hugo via Zoom, and didn't see any audience or reaction or anything. All I saw was basically my own face, and I was doing my speech and doing my little playing with my. And bringing out my He-Man figures, which I probably wouldn't have done if I actually expected to win. But since I pre-planned it, I did it that way. It was really funny because I was literally just looking at myself and sitting there at 3. It started at 3 a.m. It was after 3 a.m. It must have been in about 3:30 or 4 or something by the point. So I was sitting there in the middle of the night and giving a speech into a computer, which was actually, I think I would have been a lot more nervous if there had been a lot of people out there.
Well, true. You got to
Well
do it
deserved.
from yeah, and well deserved, and you got to do it from home, which is
Thank
great.
you. Yeah.
So I
And I
will.
got to drink champagne with. I went to my parents afterwards. I'd gotten the permission to wake them. They were both still alive at the time, and still living at home now. No one isn't. No, my father's gone, and my mom is in the nursing home. So I'd gotten the permission to wake them up, and that's what I did. And then we had champagne and fancy Belgian chocolate.
That's awesome. Well, you guys will certainly be back. I don't know if you'll be together on these panels, but I will definitely be inviting you guys again. I know.
I'd be very happy to.
Yeah,
lots I know. Of good stories here, and also some stories which are well
worth talking about.
Not worth talking about, even if there are so some stories where you think, okay, what was he thinking? Some stories like, okay, this is a controversial story, but it still deserves to be here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you guys will be back. I know, Steve, I think I've got you for Ted Sturgeon on my short list.
I believe
for the Microcosmic God. Yes. And I know, Cora, I really want to have you on the Paget, the Mimsy episode.
I would love to do that one because it's a wonderful story and I love it.
Yeah, a lot of people have asked to be on that one. If I put everyone who asked to be on that one, we'd have 17 people.
Corey, if you do discuss that, I would greatly appreciate it if at some point you mentioned the fact that there is no scene in the story where somebody cries on a rabbit plushie.
Well, you put it
familiar with the
now.
Movie Mimsy?
Yes, I know. The movie which well,
yeah.
All right, well, you put it out here, Steve. It's here. So, all right. Science Fiction Hall of Fame episode one is now in the books. Thanks for listening. And folks, please come back for this series. Look up our panelists and follow their work. I appreciate if you're nerd enough to have made it to this point, you rule. And we will see you again with Twilight by John W. Campbell. Thank you.